Oscar Poker.
I don't care about the money, it's just paper anyways. Which is the stronger, the burn or the flame? Time got you drifting, but there was nothing to say. A friend of a friend told a girl, told a man, so I'm a little late. I heard you started a band, tell me what's your sound. Now what are you guys called? You gotta tell me when you're playing out. I heard you started a band, but tell me what's your sound. And what are you guys called?
Welcome to episode 121 of Oscar Poker with Jeffrey Wells from HollywoodElsewhere.com and Sasha Stone from AwardsDaily.com. Welcome to our show. Today we'll be talking about the fallout from the surprise win of Spotlight at the SAG Awards and how that might fit into the Best Picture race. The race seems to be down to two films, The Big Short versus Spotlight, with two other movies kind of hovering on the fringe, Mad Max, Fury Road, and The Revenant. This conversation was held on an afternoon where there was a storm which knocked out our power, so we had to speak over the phone, and it sounds terrible, so please listen at your own peril. It sounds like my voice is about 5 octaves too high, and that 10 people are sort of carrying me through a rushing river, and Jeff sounds fine, so yeah.
All right, so basically, as I understand things, until last night's historic SAG Awards, which opened up the Oscar Best Picture situation, at least, somewhat surprisingly, because I had been taking the cues from both yourself and Glenn Whip, and who else was predicting the win for The Big Short last Sunday besides the two of you?
You know, I don't even know if Glenn Whip was. I didn't look at the SAG ensemble. I was looking at Best Picture. So I do know that Scott Feinberg had predicted Spotlight. I know that Ann Thompson was predicting Spotlight.
No, I'm talking about last weekend, the PGA win.
Oh.
That was you and Glenn Whip, right? You were the only ones, or there were others?
You know what I did is I looked at the Gold Derby chart, and Glenn Whip and I were the only two that had Big Short in the number one spot.
Right.
Scott Feinberg says he predicted it to win the PGA.
Okay.
But he's leaving his mind open for Best Picture. And the only reason I predicted it was because I had done the math, right? I was saying to myself, you know, well, I had been sort of calculating the stats, the Best Picture stats as we go along, you know, adding them up. Well, who has what?
Yeah.
Who usually has these awards by now? And, you know, every year that I do this, every movie has them. So, like, last year, Birdman and Boyhood both had Everything You Need. Neither one of them had any missing piece to the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, 12 Years a Slave and Gravity both had them, except Gravity was missing the SAG Ensemble nomination. And that was one key early indicator that it might not win Best Picture.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So with The Big Short, it's literally the only one this year, somehow, that has all the things you usually need to win Best Picture. So I said to myself, all right, it doesn't seem like it's going to win, but I'm just going to predict it because that's what the stats say.
Uh-huh.
And it totally won, and I was so shocked and so impressed that the stats held that I was all excited about it, but I noticed, like, no one cared.
Mm-hmm.
I went on Twitter, and it was like, none of my friends, you know, not Chris Tapley or Ann Thompson or Kyle Buchan, not one of them said, wow, that's really cool.
Uh-huh.
I was just like, man, I finally get one right.
You know, I've noticed, even though I'm not by any stretch and I've never claimed to be any kind of predictor or pulse taker, I'm, you know, pretty much a free-swinging advocate, but But I was somewhat famously, within our community at least, being the hardcore bird guy come hell or high water last year.
And
if anything, there was only denigration after it won. It was because I didn't care if anybody agreed with me. And you know, it's like they always resent you if you're right.
They resent being wrong.
And they don't like it. So basically, it's like fuck her. You know, what does she know? You know, it's always on.
I know. You know. I mean, the fluke of you getting Birdman right was astonishing. Everybody said, oh, well, he just loved the movie. He would have produced it. And that's true. But still, it's pretty damn cool that you had it in number one and nobody else did. So,
Well, that's because I never claimed to be a predictor. I'm just saying this is what I want. I don't give a shit what anybody else, whether it comes true or not.
Cool. Yeah. However you got there, it's one of those cool things that hardly ever happens. It never happens to me, you know? Yeah. I always have people lecturing me about why I shouldn't listen to the stats, mm-hmm. about why I'm going to get this and that wrong, and how I'm always wrong. And I'm like, But then the one time I was right, I didn't get that, like, high five from the community. And it's like, I know it sounds whiny and mewling and stupid to care.
Yeah.
But, you know, after all these years in the biz, you do kind of care, you know, what your peers think.
Well, no.
I thought it was pretty cool.
So anyway, before last night's SAG Awards, I had said to myself, well, look, it's time to just shift everything, do a downshift, and start being gracious, because if The Big Short's going to win, it's going to win. And it's a film that I respect. And I've seen twice, and I would like to actually see it a third time. I don't think it's in any way a problematic film. I just don't love it. You know, that's all it is.
Right.
But be gracious. Be a gentleman. You know, your pony is not going to come in the spotlight. So, or you know, and secondly, Revenant. So just ease up and take it easy. Be gracious and don't get crazy about this. So that's what I was saying to myself. And then Spotlight wins, and I was really surprised. Really surprised. So.
Yeah, and you could also add to that and be happy that you got such a long shot right last year, you know?
Yeah,
that's sort of how I was feeling. Like, I was all high that I got it right, and then I was thinking, okay, well, this is going to be it, and then boom. I'm like, wah, wah. No, you're wrong. And Thompson's right, as usual. Yeah.
So, can I ask you something? Do you agree? I mean, I think that had The Big Short won last night, the Ensemble Award, which they don't actually call the Ensemble, they call it the Best Cast or something, whatever their term is for it, but basically it's their Ensemble, and it's their version of the Best Picture Award. If it had won, I think that the momentum would be unstoppable, and the word of mouth would be unstoppable, and it would have been over. Do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. 100% right.
Right.
And I have to admit, I was surprised, because that's what we've seen, you know. We saw Birdman take the Producers Guild by surprise, and then we saw them immediately, same with Argo, we saw them immediately take SAG, and it was like, oh, shit, okay.
Mm-hmm.
This race is over.
Yeah.
But it's obviously not over.
Yeah.
A lot of people love Spotlight, and the thing it has going for it is that it's not a movie that's divisive at all.
Mm-hmm.
It has, anybody can sit down in front of it and get involved in it and understand it.
Right.
It doesn't require any sort of knowledge of Wall Street.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to follow the plot. You can just sit down, anybody, from my mom to my sister to my dad, anybody can sit down in front of it and at least get it, you know, if not love it, right? A lot of people love Spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was looking at it further, I was thinking, okay, so the SAG isn't actually that reliable. It's about 50% right since they changed to the preferential ballot.
Uh-huh.
But what's different? What's different between Spotlight winning with five movies and no Revenant or Mad Max in the mix to compete, and Big Short winning with 10 movies with Mad Max and Revenant? I realized that the difference between them is that Big Short probably won because it's probably the number two vote for people who like The Revenant and Mad Max. Like, they're not going to go Revenant. I mean, you're the only one I know that would be Revenant Spotlight. Most people are like, you know, our friend Rod Laurie or whatever. They're going to go Revenant, Big Short, Mad Max, you know. But basically, Mad Max and Revenant are going to divide up the number ones. Big Short's going to come in with a lot of number ones.
Right.
It's also going to gain number twos from their votes. Spotlight, I think, is more like a movie that would be a little more in the mainstream, kind of like a Brooklyn, Bridge of Spies, Martian kind of voter.
Right.
And since those are lower down on the ballot, I don't think that they got as much votes as Revenant and Mad Max. So that's how I think Big Short ended up on top.
Got it. Okay.
The question is, two questions remain. The first is, heading into the DGA, we have that same problem with Mad Max and The Revenant competing for votes. And then we have Big Short and Spotlight, two relatively unknown directors, both Irish. And a non-preferential ballot. So it's kind of like SAG all over again. So you'd think, given that, people would just go ahead and predict McCarthy to win.
Yeah.
Because it won the SAG with a consensus vote with five movies. But there are problems with that, because there are a couple of problems. First of all, everybody's predicting George Miller for Mad Max to win. I have a hard time with that, because I think that it's going to cancel out, and Iñárritu and him are going to sort of fight for that vote, because they're both sort of bravura, visionary.
You're talking about the Directors Guild, which is next weekend, and you don't think it's going to be Iñárritu, because they don't want to give it to him twice. He won last year, didn't he? Yes.
Right, and they're never in their history have they done it back-to-back.
Yeah, right.
But then George Miller doesn't have a BAFTA nomination for Best Director, which is equally weird. Like, that never happens either, you know?
Yeah.
So,
look, what are we learning from this, Sasha? I mean, there's so many precedents and rules that are supposed to be followed that are being broken.
Yeah, I know.
Including your basic rule, which is that you've been adopting for the last, four years, which is that if it hasn't hit theaters and opened by October or even September, the likelihood of it winning Best Picture is not high. So, you know.
Right. No. I don't say hit theaters. I always say it has to be seen, because, you know, the Telluride movies, a lot of them don't necessarily open until later, but they just have to be seen earlier. Seen at Cannes, seen at Telluride.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And Paramount, I went back and looked, and they've been screening the Big Short since October.
Okay.
So it's been out there a while, and they were really, really motivated to make sure people saw it after what happened with Selma, and everybody accused them of not sending out screeners. So they were really careful to make sure everybody saw the movie. And as you know, those screenings that we got from Rod Lurie, they went really well.
Yeah.
They were really high octane. They went a lot better than the ones we saw. The Big Short at the AFI, where people kind of walk out scratching their heads going, I don't get that movie at all, you know. So what we have is basically a race that comes down to two things. One, instinct, which is how Anne Thompson predicts. And it serves her well, because she spends a lot of time with Academy members, and she listens to what people are saying, and she's predicting Spotlight anyway to beat all of the stats that we know of.
Yeah.
To break all the stats. And then you have the other way of predicting, which is to follow the stats. And I'm so far sticking with that until the DGA tells me otherwise. If the DGA picks anybody but Adam McKay, then all bets are off.
Yeah, right.
It's still a toss-up, because with the preferential ballot, only two groups do that. That's the Producers Guild and the Academy. And they have more than five nominees, about the same amount of members, and a preferential ballot. So unless there's been a huge sea change, like unless Open Road has gotten to voters and really changed their minds about Spotlight, you're looking at the same kind of a showdown. History tells us still that it can only be the Big Short. But it doesn't seem right. It doesn't feel right. It feels like it's not going to be that. And, God, I hate to be wrong. The only thing I can do is, like, shift blame and say, follow Ann Thompson. Follow Steve Pond. They know what they're doing, you know.
Boy, if there's one person I don't like to listen to and it always bothers me, it's Ann Thompson. She's the ultimate, you know, gentle mannered, very kindly mannered, and you know, always perceptive. She always sees the undercurrents and describes them for us. But I really just has nothing gut about her. It's always measured, and everything she says bothers me. I mean, she was saying in this little chat with Eric Cohn up at Sundance. And I mean, I know what I'm talking about when I mentioned the Kenneth Lonergan film, Manchester of the Sea. This is not an opinion. I know it's superior. It's way, way, way superior to anything that showed at the Sundance Film Festival. And of course, but it wasn't in competition, so it was not, you know, mentioned in the awards that happened last night. But Anne was saying yes, it's very strong, but you know, they might have a little bit of difficulty when they go out into the market because. And she didn't say it, but basically it's one of those films that, to its immense credit, does not serve up a ending in which people are hugging and you know, happier and doing better. You know, it's just more mature than that. And
right.
And she was talking about the the simpletons who like to go to those movies, and if it doesn't have that thing that they want to see, then they're going to, you know, probably not go to it. That's what she. And I just, you sound different now. Now you're in some place that sounds different. There's an echo.
Yeah, I've come into my lobby now.
Oh, okay.
And I see that the power's on because my elevator just came on.
Okay.
So the thing is about that is that box office is really changing. We just don't know how it's going to go, but it is sort of silly to, you know, doom a film before it's even had a chance, you know.
Are you saying that she's right, that if a film has any real adult complexity and doesn't serve up the bromides that people want to absorb when they pay to see, you know, a movie at a Plex, that therefore she's right, that therefore people are becoming more simplistic and less open to you know, I mean, there's no way you can't call it a satisfying film. It's so agreeably satisfying and so complex and recognizable in terms of human behavior and emotion. So it's not in any way one of those, you know, not enough or downish films that doesn't, you know, give you that feeling of fulfillment. It certainly has that fulfillment. But you're saying that she's more or less right. It doesn't make any difference if it's good or not.
Well,
people just want what they want.
I'm not. That's just a weird thing about being in this job these days. It's like people are, you know, film critics, they're awards pundits, they're journalists, and they're box office analysts.
Yeah.
You know, so everything is kind of being analyzed all at once. I don't really know how box office works. I can't pretend that I do. But I do know that if a movie hits, if it is really deeply moving, people will find a way to see it. You know, whether it's the art house crowd, you know, or mm-hmm. it gets awards and that drives people. I just don't think that it's necessarily just because it has a downer ending, if that's what it is, then that dooms it.
I wouldn't call it a downer ending. I would say it's an ending. Would you call the ending of The Godfather Part 2 a downer ending?
It's a chilling ending. Chilling.
But it's earned. It fulfills what it is. It doesn't pull a rabbit out of the hat and say, listen, I know what you thought we were going to go in a kind of downish direction, but here's a happy ending. You know, it does the honorable thing. It sticks to what it's about, which is that guy who's... Huh?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but The Revenant just made $130 million, and that's not a very uplifting ending. So I don't know if you can go by that, because if people want to see the movie, they'll see the movie, you know what I mean? People are mature. They can handle an ending like that, you know?
What kind of ending do you think The Revenant delivered? I didn't think it delivered anything. Leonardo DiCaprio's Hugh Glass character did not die, but he certainly didn't seem settled or satisfied. He seemed a little fucked up about everything. You know, he looks in the camera and goes, "What just happened to me?" You know, it's not what I would call an up ending. You know, right?
It's not an up ending. I mean, I guess if you say,
right.
I mean, spoiler alert, but I guess if you say that he, you know, got his revenge, then that's satisfying. But I felt it to be a very the second time I saw it, I found it to be a very and the first time.
Yeah.
Just a heartbreaking ending.
Yeah.
You know, he's miserable. He's so sad. He can't bring back the people that he loves. You know, the world is about to change. Everything's fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, that just could be me being cynical, but that's the message I got from it. And The Big Short, same way. That's a bummer fucking ending.
Yeah.
And, you know, it made $60 million.
Right.
So I think people see it if they want to see it. And I don't think in this climate that you can say a downer ending isn't going to make money. And look at Steve Jobs had a happy ending.
Okay.
And maybe it would have done better if it had had a downer ending.
Well, then to get back to Ann Thompson, then you'd feel that her skepticism about Kenneth Lonergan's film, which, trust me, I'm telling you the truth, it does not deliver a quote-unquote downer ending. It delivers a sad feeling. It's not downer. There's a difference between, oh, that's a kind of, I didn't like that. That brought me in a place I didn't want to be, versus sad,
right,
which is just this, it's sad, man. You know, I don't know what to say, but it's not downer. There's a difference, a very distinct difference, I think.
Right, and that's the thing I loved about The Big Short was that, for me, it connected, and The Revenant, for that matter, and in its own way, Spotlight, you know, yeah, it's true that the good guys win, and justice is served, but it's still a huge bummer.
Yeah.
Now, there's still a lot of victims out there. It's still a tragedy.
So,
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily that. I think audiences are becoming more sophisticated.
Yeah.
And what drives them to the theater, and I don't think it's just an uplifting ending. It doesn't seem like that's what people are looking for if you look at the box office.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And I want to just get a word in on this. We've already talked about this, but I've written about this fairly extensively. But last night at the Sundance Awards, the much heralded Nate Parker film, The Birth of a Nation, which I believe was locked in people's minds as being something that they definitely wanted to applaud and cheer as much as they could. And the jury went for it as giving it a grand jury prize, and the audience award went for it for drama. So I'm clearly in a very small space in a small minority, but I'm telling you, this movie is not made of the stuff that legends are made of. It's a Owen Gleiberman, I think, said it very accurately when he said it's more or less an Ed Zwick film or a Ron Howard film. But if they had directed it, it wouldn't have won the awards. It's because it's Nate Parker. It's because a black filmmaker made it at this time when people's assumptions and values have been challenged by the Oscar so white thing, and the way, and people want very much to, obviously, not regress into not very wise attitudes and assumptions, and people want to they want to look forward. And they want to not be tedious in their viewpoints. And so they want to be, you know, better than their forebears. They want to be more open, more, you know, just not racial-minded. You know, we can't get away from being racial-minded, but, you know, disparaging in any way, shape, or form. So this is the thing that people wanted to do. So that movie came in, and it was the movie to embrace, no matter what. I'm telling you, it is not good enough to be a great movie, you know, to be thought of as a great movie, to win awards. But it doesn't seem to really matter, because if I read one review, or I read 10 of them during Sundance, saying the movie that Nate has made is almost better for what it has generated in people, and the timing, and how it arrived at this particular point, it's better than what it actually is when you look at it just as a movie.
Right. Well, I feel like with that, first of all, I haven't seen it, so I can't render a judgment. I did read Manola Dargis's piece on Sundance, and she talks a bit about it, and she is as equally on the fence as you are. You know, she does talk about how it is half great and half not great, you know, and she's honest about it. She does say there, you know, he makes a few poor choices with visuals.
Yeah.
Probably should have been taken out.
Yeah.
And that can potentially ruin an otherwise really great expression of a story. The thing I like about it is that, well, here, I have two comments. One is that in my world, it's very frustrating because people want to champion women. We've talked about this before, they want to champion women filmmakers to the point where they forgive their shitty movies. And I feel like, you know, that is so frustrating because it's like treating women like they're blind or they're, you know, missing arms and they directed a movie, like treating them like they're so handicapped they can't even say, that movie sucked. And so when they say, oh, here, 52 days of women filmmaking, mm-hmm. I'm thinking, are these movies going to be any good? Or are they just going to be like, he loved me, he doesn't love me, you know,
yeah.
That kind of crap, you know? Give me a movie that's about bigger ideas, and that gives me something to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I wouldn't want to be patronized if I was a female filmmaker. I want them to just tell me the truth. You know, is it a good movie? Is it good enough? You know,
well,
yes,
Tasha, I'm telling I've ever told you one thing that is truthful. Nate Parker and his film have been patronized. By being so unquestionably praised by so many people and winning these awards. And you know, I've heard from people, oh, I hear it's the hit of the festival. I can't wait to see it. And I write back to them and say, listen, go see it and tell me what you think. But look, don't get your hopes up too high. It's really been overpraised. And that is being patronized, you know, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that if I was him. I would want people to tell me the truth, you know. Tell me if you think it's good. That's me. But on the other hand, about Nate Parker, is when I read about what that story is about, I thought that's really interesting. I'd like to see that movie because I don't know a lot about that slave revolt.
Yeah.
Now, I've never heard of it before. It's never taught in history class.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that, to your knowledge, the Nat Turner Rebellion of 1831 is not something that is commonly taught in schools?
No, definitely not. Absolutely not. And so that's a subject I'm interested in, you know. I'm interested in the history of slavery and civil rights. And
yeah.
I think that we, you know, it was serious war crimes were committed. And I don't think enough stories are told about it. And I'm always saying people should go back through history and look at all these great stories that haven't been told. Well, that comes with two problems. One, the black community says, you know, enough with the stories about slavery. There's more to us. We've evolved, you know.
Yeah.
We're living regular lives, you know. Please start telling more stories about who we really are instead of this. So that's one problem that the movie's going to have to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm excited to see it. I think it'll make a shitload of money. I think Fox Searchlight was right to pick it up because you know it's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know it's going to do like $80 million or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what to say because I haven't seen it, so I can't criticize it.
Well, let me tell you something. There is, if I were Fox Searchlight, I would buy it, but the deal would be, Nate, we got to trim some stuff. It's too excessive in some ways. There are at least two, and possibly three shots of what would be, you know, I have to describe them as basically celestial cosmic figures who are kind of opening their arms to Nat Turner, and one of them is a woman who's kind of an angel figure, a black woman, but very pretty and smiling at him like she's some kind of showgirl in Las Vegas, and it's awful to throw that stuff in. You know, I mean, if you don't understand that there is a spiritual component to Nat Turner's rebellion, to the people who stood with him, and you have to be told in so many words that the angels in heaven are on his side, that's terrible filmmaking. I mean, either you get what dignity is about and what that man did on his own, and I think that, you know, to enshrine him as someone who basically, killed some landowners, it wasn't that, you know, cut and dried from what I understand. I mean, Nate Parker said that William Styron's book was untruthful. Maybe he's right, I don't know. But he's built up this guy. He's determined to enshrine him and make him a little on the almost like the Christ-like level. You know, like the heavens were with him. We are told at the beginning that he's got some amazing potential, some kind of something in his future that's going to be very important, very profound. And he's told that as a kid. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I just hate as a filmmaker. I don't want to be told how wonderful somebody is. I want to see them do what they do and let me figure out if I think it's wonderful or not. Just don't instruct me about how, you know, profound and important a person is.
Yeah, I think that's in Manella Dargis's review, too, something about that, something about the God part of it, you know, the religious figure, the martyr.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I love that he's trying these, inventive kind of storytelling techniques. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. But, you know, if it was Harvey Weinstein getting that movie, he would have definitely told him to shape it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Take this out, take that out. They reshaped, you know, they screened 12 Years a Slave all over the place. And they kept cutting and reshaping and cutting and reshaping and then screening again and seeing what people thought and cutting and reshaping. I mean, that movie was very carefully trimmed. It wasn't just raw.
You mean post Telluride it was carefully trimmed?
Yes, before Telluride, yes.
No, I'm asking you after I saw it at Telluride. Are you telling me it was trimmed after that?
No, before that.
Okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah, before that. I didn't know until I talked to one of the guys at the production company that's what they did. But they were really careful with it. You know, they wanted to, I know, they wanted to win Best Picture. And you know, they kept trimming and screaming and asking people what they thought. And, you know, it was really carefully cultivated to be what it was.
Sure.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I'm looking forward to that whole process. But I'm just telling you, that was... And we'll see what we'll see. I don't want to hammer on this relentlessly, but last night's awards kind of started me up because it's obviously the toast of the Sundance Film Festival, and people are going to, be very receptive to it and be very their high expectations for sure because they've been primed to expect something fairly special and fairly profound. So. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and some people will like it and some people won't. And if they cut it, you know, maybe it'll win Critics Awards, you know? Who knows if that's their goal. But I think if making money is their goal, they're not going to have to do much. You know, the buzz from this, the subject matter, the audience that will go see it, it'll make money. So it was a smart buy.
Okay.
I think. We'll see. But there's no way it's going to bomb.
It's
never going to bomb.
No, I can't imagine it will be. It's probably going to be a very popular film. So
the only slight controversy that's going to hit it are, you know, Nate Parker's past, which people keep bringing up.
Yep.
And it might turn into an internet thing. You and I both think it's nonsense, so we're not even going to talk about it. But it is there. It is something to.
It's really not. It was that briefly out, but I'll tell you my belief. Is that it's absurd. I mean, he was, it turned out that the woman at Penn State who had made an accusation, apparently closer to date rape than rape, but then she said under oath that it was consensual with Nate. The other guy, different story. And for some reason, it took 2 whole years for his reputation to be completely, you know, clean because of, you know, he was completely exonerated. There's nothing hanging over him. Nothing happened of an an unpalatable nature, and so, you know, it's nothing. So.
So why are people? I know, but you see it on Twitter. I don't know if you do, but people are always sending me stuff about it. They're just flat out calling him a rapist. You know, so
calling him a racist? Why?
A rapist.
Oh! Yeah. Well, it's not true. I mean, I did a little bit of reading. It just seemed fairly cut and dried. The woman who accused said that he was, it was consensual. I read that.
Right.
I'll find it again. But that's what I read. And secondly, that it happened in '99, the original incident. 2 years later, he was, his legal record was completely, clean, and there was no issue about, you know, anything. He was totally in the clear. So
And then the other thing is going to be this, you know, this woman wrote this article about how they don't want any more movies about slavery and how Hollywood only wants movies about slavery. But that's sort of weird because this isn't really Hollywood. This is like Nate Parker's life dream. So it's not like Hollywood said, you know, here, go make this movie because we all want a movie about slavery. But but it's still going to be a thing that's going to be like think pieced around and.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I have a feeling that all over different parts of the country, I think Fox Searchlight is picking up on that vibe as you have.
Yeah.
You know, the Black Lives Matter, the Oscars so white, all that stuff is going to drive this movie's box office up.
Yeah.
But it
yeah.
was a smart buy, you
yeah.
know, for
yeah.
sure.
Right.
And you know, it matters. It kind of matters less, you know, what. If the film gets good reviews anymore for that particular thing, it sort of has a built-in audience.
Right.
You know?
You've been listening to episode 121 of Oscar Poker with Jeffrey Wells from HollywoodElsewhere.com and Sasha Stone from AwardsDaily.com. We'll be back next week with another episode. The bumper music was Started a Band by Kid and Bent by Harriet off their album American Appetite. Thanks for listening.
And it gets hard when you've lost all your control. I'm running in circles, ducking the hurdles. And it would help to know what went wrong. 'Cause it's easy to get bought, but it's hard to be sold. Pushing through silence and piles of violence. I should leave, but I won't go. And I'm open to head of shame. And I can't stop falling you. I drove out of my way. And I'm all bent out of shape. Out of my way, and I'm open to